Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
Now, straight from the headlines, we bring you the latest top newsmakers.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at the San Diego Performance Academy. My special guest today is Eric Larson, the Executive Director of the San Diego County Farm Bureau. Eric, welcome to the show.
Miriam, thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, a lot of people may be surprised to know just how much agriculture contributes to the San Diego County economy.
Well, you know, most people in San Diego are going to have a beach or a freeway orientation. You got to get off the beaten path to find the farms, but they're out there, and we have a lot of them, nearly 6,000 farms in San Diego County. We're in the top 20 of all farm economies in the entire United States, of the 3,000 counties that have farming.
That's amazing. And I've heard that we have more family farms than under 10 acres than any county in America.
Yeah, more small family farms in San Diego County than any place else. We're a real bastion of small family farms. And we really like that. We work hard to keep them all in business. Yeah. But as far as the economy goes, agricultural crops are worth about $1.7 billion a year in the county, and 20 to 30,000 people in San Diego County depend on those farms for their jobs.
Very, very important part of our economic engine here in San Diego County, then. What are some of the leading crops out there? And also, is agriculture increasing in our county?
Yeah, if you go back historically, the leading crops in the county have changed over the years. They changed and changed and changed. Mm-hmm. We did field crops, and we had dairy and tomatoes on the coast. But in the late 1970s, San Diego County really became a center for growing ornamental crops because we have such great weather here and we can grow the crops 12 months a year. So ornamental crops, and that's everything from cut flowers to indoor house plants to the plants you use to landscape your yard, is the leading crop here. And it counts
very
for about,
interesting. So it isn't oranges anymore.
Yeah, it's not oranges. Most people will guess avocados. You say, what's the top crop in San Diego County? Yeah. Avocados is that big guess.
It was at one time, right?
It was for a very short period of time in the early 1970s. Mm-hmm. But again, once the ornamentals came here and folks started building greenhouses and growing ornamental crops and shipping them from here all across the nation, we had nurseries relocate here from other parts of the country, and the ones here grew. So the nurseries now account for about two-thirds of our agricultural production that continues to grow, but not at the expense of the other segments. The other segments, some of them are still doing very well. It's just the nurseries have grown tremendously.
I know you've mentioned wine. Grapes and olives are two other crop areas that are growing.
Yeah, the wine grape production, it's still small, but if it continues to increase at the rate it is, it's going to become a bigger segment of the industry here. So wine grapes are popular. We've got, 3 million people in San Diego County, 20 million people in Southern California. Mm-hmm. Why shouldn't we have a robust local wine market?
That
goes for anything else that we can grow local. But a lot of folks are deciding to have a go at the wine business. And as you drive around places like Ramona and Fallbrook and Valley Center, it's hard to come around a corner anymore and not see a new planting of wine grapes.
Yeah, we see that in East County too. There seem to be vineyards popping up everywhere. And people note that it's also a more fire-safe form of landscaping, too, replacing some of the things that were more fire-prone out here. What about the future of something like hemp? There's been talk at the national level. Some of the farm organizations are calling for the decriminalization of hemp growing now.
Well, industrial hemp is really not related to the marijuana that's grown as a mind-altering drug. So you can't. But for some reason, there's just been this decision that you shouldn't be able to grow the industrial hemp here. In a place like California, we're happy to – people will sell it and buy the clothing, but they just don't want us to grow it here.
Interesting.
Over time, I think that will change. Just some minds have to be changed on that still and get that done. But, you know, it has the possibility. I can't see us ever growing at any large scale in San Diego County. We don't have much flat land, and water prices are so high that I really think it's going to lend itself to places where the land is flat and they can mechanize.
Which brings us to one of the major topics we wanted to talk about today, and that is the impact of the drought on agriculture, both locally and, for that matter, statewide. Eric, what's the latest you're hearing, including any good news there may be from the recent storms?
Well, the storms were great. They didn't end the drought, but California is in pretty dire straits. If you look at the entire state, we have a water system that was completed when there were about 17 million people in the state. Now there's 37 million people in California using the same water system. So just do the math.
Yeah, we've had the state saying they were going to cut off water completely to some of the farmlands, especially up in the Central Valley, which is the heart of much of the agriculture for the state, and the feds offering some relief. And I guess the latest, the governor saying there's some kind of drought relief bill on the way. But you've noted to me that there's a real difference in, it's kind of an ant and grasshopper story here, in terms of how San Diego County has prepared for drought versus, say, farmers, some of the big agribusiness operations up in the Central Valley and elsewhere. Tell us about that.
Yeah, up in Northern California in the Central Valley, there's some farmers who are going to be getting zero allocation here. They're getting no water this year so far. These
really
recent
scary
storms may change that a little bit, but if they've got permanent crops like almond trees or walnut trees or pistachios, they'll have to tear them out. They'll have to take those trees out.
Wow.
And that would really be unfortunate if that happens.
It takes a lot of years to grow a tree. It's not like going 1 year fallow on, say, some other kind of crop.
So true. If you're growing tomatoes or cotton, you just don't plant that year. But if you've got a permanent crop, you've got to keep that tree alive. Situation in San Diego County is very different. We have to look at the Metropolitan Water District and the County Water Authority that bring water to us. Terrible droughts in the mid-70s, terrible drought that ended in 1992. And both those times, those agencies said, look, we have to insulate ourselves. We have to arm ourselves. And so they went out and looked at other sources of water. So for instance, we do a very good job in Southern California on using recycled water. We've done a great job. We have a very low per capita use of water in Southern California. We import water from the Colorado River. We've made an exchange with the farmers in the Imperial
Valley.
And
the Colorado River, though, has also, the federal government has also cut back the sales from the Colorado River, I understand.
Not yet. There's a threat that could happen, but they have it's 100% of normal on the precipitation on the Colorado River this year. So we're not looking to see any cuts coming there. But the point I was getting to is just the fact that we've got this very diverse portfolio of water in Southern California. So even though Northern California is very dry, we still have other sources. Plus, we have a lot of water in storage. So as San Diegans at this point, all we're doing is voluntary conservation, while in other parts of the state, they're getting zero water. So there's a real dynamic difference.
Now, what about the farmers themselves? How water efficient is the irrigation that's used by San Diego County farmers compared to what we may see elsewhere?
In other parts of the state, I'm really not that familiar, but I will tell you here in San Diego County, the farmers have invested over the years in the latest in technology. The reason being, no one pays more for water than we do.
Right, so they have
so it's very,
had
very
an
expensive.
Incentive.
So the farmers, there was no choice. If you were going to survive and you were going to stay in farming, you had to invest heavily in technology, reduce your water usage, and get the most production per gallon of water that you use. So farmers have already done that. Those who chose not to make that investment, they've probably already gone away.
Yeah. Now, the Farm Bureau, a lot of people out there may not know, but listeners, if you're looking for information about where you can find things like all the farmers markets that are certified countywide, community-supported agriculture, in other words, farms that will sell goods directly to consumers, some of them even deliver, you can find that on the Farm Bureau website. Tell us, first of all, Eric, what your website is, and then a little bit about what kind of growth you're seeing in those areas.
Yeah, on the Farm Bureau website at www.sdfarmbureau.org, or just Google Farm Bureau San Diego or locally grown San Diego, and you'll get our website. So we try to keep the most up-to-date roster of farm stands, what we call CSAs, Community Supported Agriculture, where people can actually have a subscription with a farmer to get regular weekly deliveries.
Something pretty new, right? A few years ago,
it's fairly new and very, very popular.
Yeah.
Very popular. People really like that. And then the farmers markets, of course.
Sure.
Nearly 50 farmers markets in San Diego County. If you want to buy local, it's not hard here because we've got lots of farmers markets.
Right.
All those things times contact we have on our Farm Bureau website. We've decided to be the central gathering point on our website for all those local efforts.
Now, locally, the farmers markets and everything is also creating some jobs in some much-needed areas. We're seeing refugee farmers, for example, from around the world coming here and getting into that.
Yeah, you really have to give kudos to a group called the International Rescue Committee. They work out of City Heights. They deal with refugees from around the world, and they've been working very hard to create urban farming opportunities for refugees. Mm-hmm. A lot of these folks will come from foreign countries with farming skills, but may not be able to make the connection to get a chunk of land to do that. So we're very hopeful that these efforts will be successful. We have an aging farmer population in the United States. It's kind of a critical situation.
Yeah, nationally, that's been an issue, right, with the young people grow up and they move off to the big city or something, and how do you keep them down on the farm, as the old song goes?
Yeah, I forget what the number is, but the average age of a farmer in the United States and in California is around 59 or 60, and that number keeps creeping up. Well, if that number creeps up, that means there's nobody new coming in at the bottom.
So what are the solutions you see to that?
Well, you know, I'm very hopeful on things like these refugee farmers coming into San Diego County. You know, we have this great population of folks from Mexico that live in San Diego County, and a lot of those people may have, or Central America, South America, may have farming skills here.
Right.
So I think we have a great opportunity for a foreign-born group of folks to come in and become farmers in San Diego County, embrace the urban agriculture, even if it's not full-time. Mm-hmm. You know, find a vacant lot, find a couple acres, farm it, send it to farmer's market.
Yeah, and certainly the local cities are helping with that in terms of legalizing things like chicken ownership. A lot of the East County cities in San Diego have done that. Even goats and beekeeping in some of these areas.
The city of San Diego has taken a real leadership role on that and attempting to embrace urban agriculture. And the county of San Diego is doing as well. The county is working very hard now at doing the same thing.
Yeah, jumping ahead there a little bit, Supervisor Jacob, I know, has talked about a vision for encouraging more things like cheese making, and we had the boutique winery ordinance to help the wineries, and even going the next step to agritourism. I mean, what would you envision as the potential future for agritourism out here?
Well, you know, again, the 3 million people in Southern California, 20 million or 3 million in San Diego County, 20 million in Southern California, all the tourists that come here looking for something else to do after they've gone to the beach and gone to the zoo and gone to Legoland. You know, why not go onto the farms and see what farmers are doing? It's so interesting to see what farmers do. So agritourism makes sense.
The people in the city and the urban areas to come out east and
see what's out
here.
And realize that those oranges didn't come from the store, that they actually grew on a tree.
Are you concerned at all to the threat to some of our ag lands from some of the other kinds of development coming in, some of these massive energy projects that want to take up thousands of acres of what was agricultural land?
Yeah, it is problematic because if you want to build an energy farm, you're looking for nice flat land, the same land where the farmers were. And that's what we do at the Farm Bureau. We're trying to work all the time to make sure that the farmers can remain profitable. Mm-hmm. Farming is a lifestyle choice. It's not necessarily the best business plan in the world. But farmers will continue to farm as long as they have a reasonable expectation to make a profit.
So they have a love of the land.
Love of the land. So if they can be successful, that will fend off development. That will fend off these other things that come in and threaten the farmland.
We also have ranching out here, too. We have cattle ranches. And I know not long ago interviewed a guy that's selling natural beef now.
We bought 200,000 acres of grazing land in our county. That's substantial. And when we talked about the drought a minute ago, we didn't really mention the fact that the low rainfall in San Diego County has really caused a problem for those cattle ranchers in East County because there's not as much natural feed out there as they would expect. So they've had to buy hay to supplement. Very, very expensive for them.
So it's drought to the degree we're having an impact. Here it's hitting the ranchers harder right now than, say, the guys with the nurseries and the greenhouses.
Very true. But so the drought's also impacting the folks that grow avocados and oranges because they expect to not have to irrigate much in December, January, and February and buy that expensive water. So they've been hurt as well.
Now, let's talk about a couple of other challenges and threats, so to speak, to the agricultural industry in California and even right here in San Diego. I know you mentioned that one of them is the difficulty in finding farm labor. How is that situation and what solution would you like to see to that, Eric?
Well, the last time we had a legalization in the United States for farm workers was in the 1985 or 1986. Mm-hmm. So we have this aging population of farm workers, and admittedly, and the farm community is not afraid to admit this, The majority of farm workers in this country now are working with forged documents. There's been this vacuum. There's been this demand. So folks have gotten forged documents.
Because
so they
of the,
could,
the crackdown on immigration.
The crackdown on immigration. But they can get these documents and they can go and present them. The farmers have to fill out the I-9 forms like any other employer does. And these documents look so good. Mm-hmm. That's a really bad model.
So you're saying we need some form of immigration reforms or amnesty? Or what would the answer be?
The term amnesty to me means nothing anymore.
Yeah.
It's been thrown around. It's people just want to, if they want to throw some lightning out there, they say the word amnesty. The Farm Committee would have hoped that there could have been some kind of comprehensive immigration reform. Don't see that that's going to happen, but we need something for agriculture. The reality is, if we want to remain a strong country agriculturally, be a leading producer of food, produce our own food, our crops will be planted and harvested by foreign-born workers. There's no getting around that because most native-born Americans are not raising their children to be farm workers. So if we could have a guest worker program where we could vet these individuals, show that they have a work ethic, show that they have no criminal record, they've paid their back taxes, they're enrolled in an English learning class, why wouldn't we want them to travel across the border to come up here and do agricultural work? And then when the season's over, travel back home. Right now, we have no system that does that.
Yeah.
And so we've got this constant shortage, and farmers find it very difficult to harvest their crops on time to hit the very best market windows because there's not enough workers right now. If that's the case, then we're going to see more agriculture move offshore. And if we don't like imported oil, we're really going to be unhappy about imported food.
Yeah, they use all kinds of pesticides that aren't even legal in the U.S. Could be slave labor for all we know. So that is very troubling. I think it'd be interesting to see what steps, if any, Congress takes on that one.
Yeah, so far they haven't been very interested in taking any steps at all.
Now, another threat to local agriculture that's maybe even more imminent than that is the very serious Asian citrus psyllid that wiped out, I think, something like 40% of the citrus trees in Florida in 1 year. Tell us what the current situation is for this very frightening pest here in California, specifically in San Diego and East County.
Yeah, as the name implies, that insect does come from Asia. It found its way into South America, then worked up across the land bridge and eventually into the United States. You're right. Florida's been devastating, absolutely devastating. Florida's not the citrus industry it once was. But we now have that pest in San Diego County, clear up as far north as Kern County and Tulare County in California. It's a very small insect. If it was just the insect, we wouldn't be that worried about it.
The little red eyes.
Yeah, we would control it. We wouldn't worry about it. It doesn't damage the trees that much. But that insect is a vector. It carries in its gut an infection called Wang Long Bing disease.
Right, Wang Long Bing.
We call it citrus greening.
Yeah.
But what it does is when that insect has fed on an infected tree, and then feeds on another infected tree, it moves the disease from tree to tree.
Right.
And as the name implies, the fruit never gets ripe. It just stays green, and then the tree dies.
Yeah, it can look kind of lopsided. Yeah. I've seen pictures of it, too. Yeah. The leaves
you can't sell it.
Yeah. Now, I guess the good news, if there is any, is that California has been right on top of this problem. And at least so far, there's only been one tree, I understand, or one place in the whole state that actually got the citrus greening disease, which will kill trees 100% of the time. So it's important that you treat for the insect, correct? But the insect has been found, what, all over San Diego County?
All over San Diego County and 18 new sites it was found in the last month or something like that.
Wow, I know several of those were East County.
And that was when it was cool. When the weather gets warm and insects start to really reproduce and go, we expect. So the strategy we're operating under right now is the farmers in San Diego County are working together in the various areas like San Pasquale Valley, Palma Valley, Fallbrook, Valley Center, Rancho Santa Fe, and all spraying at the same time to try to knock down the population.
And that's really the only answer, unfortunately, is the spraying. There's no pest that's known to eat this insect.
There is a biological control, but it looks like it's never going to be better than, like, say, about 40% control.
Yeah, with something that could kill the entire industry.
And so it'll help. But for right now, following the Florida model, or not following the Florida model, the work is for the growers to coordinate and suppress the population. So if we do get the disease, it won't run so rampant through the
orange
groves.
People who just have backyard citrus, should they be checking for this? And where can they get more information on how to tell if they might possibly have this pest or even the disease, and what to do about it if they do.
The pest feeds on the newest foliage of the tree, and what we call a flush, when there's new growth on the tree, and that's where you would look. I'm not going to attempt to describe what it looks like here and tell someone how to identify it, but if you go online and you just type in Asian citrus psyllid,
which is spelled PSYLLID, or just citrus greening.
And you'll see the insect, and there's some great photos of what the insect looked like. It's tiny. It's tiny, tiny, tiny. But it ends up producing such mass. You see the mass of them. And you can end up finding them. They have systems where you can tap them, and they fall onto a piece of white paper.
There you go.
But nonetheless, you can learn how to discern it. If you do have the pest, it is suggested you do spray your trees. There are pesticides that you can use that are systemic, but if you want to grow more organically, or you want to do organically and you're worried about the pesticides, you can use spray oils, which you can buy at your local garden center, and those oils will also kill the Asian citrus psyllid. You just have to stay on top of it.
Yeah.
Spray and continue to check and keep the population.
Right, because once you get the disease, there's really no option but to remove the tree because it's going to die anyway.
No, and we're really hopeful that the disease does show up here in San Diego County in a residential neighborhood, that everybody in that neighborhood will understand their trees have to come out, because the disease will be latent for 2 to 3 years. So if it's found at one home, it's quite possibly it's moved throughout that neighborhood.
Right.
So citrus is at risk, and we're hoping on behalf of the commercial citrus growers, when folks do have in their neighborhood, they'll be very cooperative.
There you go. Now, on a more positive note, one thing the Farm Bureau does every year is to hold an annual farm tour. I've been on this. It's just fascinating. You always seem to find this amazing mix of farms that people can go visit. And, you know, it's just a fun thing to do. But also, if you're interested in possibly looking at agriculture as a career, or growing grapes, or becoming a vintner, or a flower farmer, or whatever it might be, this is really a neat opportunity. And it's also something that kids enjoy, too. There's usually farm animals involved that you can go see. So tell us about this year's tour, Eric.
Yeah, it's called Farm Tour Day, and it's going to be on June 7th this year. And it's something we started a few years. We kept getting these requests for tours, and you know, we're working with the farmers, so we weren't really intermixing with the public that well and organizing these tours. But wait a minute, why don't we just do it all in one day? So we had a tour the first year. I think we attracted around 100 people. This year we'll go over 1,000 people.
Wow.
We'll show up.
And I understand.
And we will just open up a number of farms. It's like an open house. And tours happen every half hour on these farms. We're going to be out in East County this year. We're going to be in Lakeside. We're lining up the farms right now. And people can go to these farms that start at 9 in the morning. And you go to a farm, and every half hour a tour takes place. So no matter when you arrive, you know, on the hour, the half hour, and the farmer themselves is going to take you on a tour of their farm, tell you what they do. And when you're done at that farm, then you just drive yourself to the next farm and take another tour.
And you can go in any order you want to.
You go any order you want to. You can stop for lunch in between, and people just have a great time.
Are they going to have the you know, lunch service this year?
Well, you know, sometimes it depends on the remoteness of the locations. If you're going to be driving by some food locations, then we don't have a lunch provision at the site. It kind of depends on what the tour. We haven't quite made that decision yet.
Yeah, sometimes they've done farm fresh foods.
Yeah, probably in another month, we'll have that up on our website. Again, sdfarmbureau.org, and everybody enrolls for the tour they pick. We'll have three tours this year. I think we're going to have East County out in the Lakeside area, Valley Center, and Fallbrook and East Oceanside. You just sign up for them. We'll have a description there of the farms. You're going to be on those tours, and you sign up for whatever tour you want.
Well, we'll certainly, as the event gets closer, we'll also have information up in the festivals and events section and the calendar section at eastcountymagazine.org as well about the East County tour for our listeners.
That would be great.
Well, Eric, I want to thank you very, very much for joining us today on the East County Magazine show on KNSJ.
Well, I'm really thankful that you invited me. I've enjoyed this a lot.
This is Leon Thompson reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ Radio. The Rural Fire Protection District will soon be no more. On March 4th, the board's majority voted to dissolve the district and join the County Fire Authority. Its volunteer firefighters will be gone unless they can complete additional training and rigorous physical testing required to become part of the County Fire Authority. The county has threatened to take away funding from the Rural Fire District if it would not dissolve, leaving many board members and residents feeling there was little choice but to acquiesce to the county's wishes. Board member R. Terry, in a previous meeting, said that if the district remained independent, they would have to do this without the $3.2 million the county provides and rely only on about $1 million that the district collects on its own. Board member Lou Russo voted against dissolving the district. He says he intends to pursue a protest allowed under the Local Agency Formation Commission, or LAFCO, that would put the issue on the ballot to let the people decide. But that requires signatures from 25% of the district's voters. Russo said he views the county takeover of the district as nothing more than a power grab. He's also asking why residents in some Alpine areas did not receive a letter about the proposed action so that they could attend the meeting. The county has contended that consideration of fire districts in rural areas would lead to better coordination and improved fire protection under the leadership of CAL FIRE officials. But not everyone agrees with that assessment. Some committees have resisted county takeover of their fire districts, notably Julian, which raised funds from a private donor to remain independent. Some residents have also raised concern that the county has not guaranteed fire protection in its charter, leading to fears that the county could someday pull out of the fire protection business as it did back in the 1970s, leaving residents in rural areas on their own. Russo had asked the Rural Fire Protection District to fund a meeting with the district's consultant to discuss the LAFCO protest process, but his request was denied by Dale Amato. Amato stated in an email to Russo that board members should all be pulling in the same direction and that any protest spearheaded by Russo should be on his own dime, not at taxpayers' expense. Russo fired back, "The majority opinion is not by nature the correct opinion. A minority opinion is vital to democracy," adding, "The protest process is designed to put more of the decision into the hands of the citizens of the district." Russo has asked that the matter be added to the agenda for the next Rural Fire Protection District meeting. But even if he succeeds in getting enough signatures for a ballot measure, a daunting prospect on its own, that still leaves the question of how to make up for millions of dollars in funding cuts if the district voters decline to join the county authority. The Rural Fire Protection District currently operates 14 stations across the southwest portions of the county from Hamul East to Hakumba, but it would likely require a substantial tax increase to fund firefighting for rural communities if voters opt to remain independent.
A wildfire over the weekend caused major headaches for motorists and sparked concerns among rural residents. The gunfire was named for the location where it started, close to a shooting range near Pine Valley at Old Highway 80 and Sunrise Highway. The fire caused power outages across much of East County and forced closure of Interstate 8 for over 2 hours on Saturday. The blaze briefly threatened the Sunrise Power Link. Other power lines were shut down by SDG&E to protect firefighters battling the blaze near the lines, leaving hundreds of residents in Pine Valley, Buckman Springs, Hapatool, Lake Moreno, Guate, and Mount Laguna without power, some all night long as firefighters battled the blaze. High winds with gusts up to 70 miles an hour complicated the situation and caused firefighting aircraft to be briefly grounded. By Sunday, the fire was 30% contained after charring over 125 acres, and the U.S. Forest Service said it could take days to fully extinguish all hot spots, with more than 250 firefighters battling the fire. The cause of the wildfire is not yet known, as of our show taping deadline, though shooting has caused numerous past fires across our backcountry. With tinder dry brush across the backcountry areas, residents are asked to be sure and clear brush around structures and avoid high fire risk activities. If you see a fire, be sure to report it promptly by calling 911. Reporting for East County Magazine and KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery. This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation.
This is Miriam Raftery with this week's local government report. Supervisor Diane Jacobs' proposal to expand veteran services to several county libraries in rural areas will be on the agenda for the San Diego supervisors on Tuesday. She introduced the measure following an East County Magazine investigation, which found there are no county veteran services in rural areas of East County or anywhere east of La Mesa. El Cajon has since been added, and now up to three additional libraries may be expanded to include veteran services. The supervisor's agenda also includes a proposal to streamline the process for holding farmers markets in unincorporated areas of the county. In addition, supervisors will consider a pilot program to investigate and prosecute crimes committed against residents of long-term care facilities. Supervisors will also consider allowing the Audubon Society to purchase a 28-acre tax-defaulted property to expand the Silverwood Wildlife Sanctuary in Lakeside. In addition, supervisors will also be discussing possible regulation of e-cigarettes. El Cajon's City Council on Tuesday will also hear a staff report and comments from the public on regulating electronic cigarettes and hookahs. The council is expected to then direct the city manager to prepare amendments to broaden the city's tobacco definition to perhaps allow regulation of these items, as well as a cost recovery program for licensing inspections of tobacco and smoke shops. The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
You're listening to the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso, from the desert to the coast.
This is Leon Thompson with a missing person bulletin. The San Diego County Sheriff's Department is asking for the public's help in finding 14-year-old Venicia Ortiz from Alpine. Venicia was last seen on February 24th. She is known to hang out along Imperial Avenue and 24th Street in the Grant Hill area of San Diego, as well as National City in Chula Vista. She may be in the company of 28-year-old Edgar Morales. Venicia is Hispanic, 5'3" tall, 160 pounds, with brown hair and brown eyes. She was last seen with highlights in her hair and pierced ears. If you have any information about her whereabouts, please call the Sheriff's Department at 858-565-5200. That's 858-565-5200.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. I'm here with Ed Pifard. Ed is an active volunteer with the California Native Plant Society. Ed, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
We're going to be talking today about native plants and, for starters, the impact on native plants of some of these controlled burns, such as the large burn that we had recently up in Cuyamaca. In your view, what kind of impacts are these controlled burns having, Ed, on the native plant species?
We live in Southern California, which has a fire ecology, and a fire ecology that's really poorly understood by modern people. The Indians had a very intimate knowledge of it.
Right.
I think the different agencies in the county have different agendas where that's concerned. Obviously, the state biologists are trying to improve the native plant diversity and protection, things like that. Cal Fire is interested in protecting primarily property. They don't necessarily have to be in conflict. I think, though, a lot of the things that Cal Fire may want to do is counterproductive. So as far as the burns are concerned, I think that the timing of year is probably not great. I think they did that primarily because they were trying to prevent it from getting out of control.
If you do a control burn in July when it's dry, it's easy for it to
burn a lot more than you want. The problem of burning in this time of year, even though we had a very dry year, is that the native plants are in active growth cycle. So what you're ending up doing is killing virtually everything that's good, and the weeds have no problem in then jumping ahead. Now, we had a rain right afterwards. The weeds are going to take a jump in there. We have a huge non-native weed problem in Southern California. California. Mm-hmm. It impacts the environment very heavily, and a lot of human activities encourage that. The Indians would never have allowed a burn during winter or spring. It was really? Actually prohibited in their culture.
Fascinating.
It was a crime, because what it did was it ruined their food source for the summer. It was something that somebody might have done to somebody as a punishment.
Well, then what is the answer if you're not going to have the controlled burns in the winter? What is the answer to prevent the devastating firestorms that we've seen so often in this region?
Well, I think it's one of the things that's kind of missing from the picture in our local environment. I mean, what the Indians did is relatively impractical in the modern world, because, you know, people live all through areas where in wooden houses that they probably shouldn't have built, but they're there now, so we
True,
have to
that
deal with it.
Wildland urban interface.
Yeah, and people like to live in a beautiful, they like to live in a natural park, but then the park is actually a threatening thing to their property. Mm-hmm. But what's missing from the biological picture, of course, is the large animals that used to live in Southern California. And I think with judicial use of large animal grazing, they can keep the weeds down.
So you would favor, for example, allowing cattle or horses to be grazed at, say, a state park?
Yeah. Well, horses and cattle are not necessarily bad. They primarily, cattle love weeds. Weeds, cattle, and humans have all evolved together in Europe. We have brought all of that with us.
Very interesting. And they don't eat the native species as
they
well?
They will. They tend to eat them last. I know that people have said, as far as like native grasses are concerned, cattle prefer native grasses and can reduce their population. Native grasses, though, are almost non-existent. I mean, they're very, in Cuyamaca State Park, there's quite a lot of them, quite a healthy. But if you go to Mission Trails and you see their quote-unquote grassland, there's a few bunches here and there, and primarily it's all filled in with weeds. Cattle could actually help that situation a lot. I know this is a bit of a controversial subject, but the thing is, a lot of San Diego had been overgrazed over the centuries, and that's primarily because human beings want to make a profit.
Right.
And if these things were used in a non-profit basis, it could easily figure out how, and I'm sure the science has already been done probably, with how many cattle per acre and move them at a certain times of year, things like that.
So it's a matter of balance, like so many things. You've been in touch with Craig Maxwell, who showed you some of the photos that he took. He's the cabin owner who was there in the middle of this burn and got some photos both during the burn and after that showed some saplings burn, 15-foot-tall saplings, some mature, appeared to be pine and cedar trees, as well as an awful lot of the underbrush and grasses. What was your reaction to what happened up there based on seeing those photos?
I believe Craig found out that they or asked them, and they said that they prefer a burn every 5 to 10 years. I think that's much, much too often. Unfortunately, fuels build up. What a lot of the locals were saying in the comment section of that article was that why doesn't the state come in and do wood chipping and things like that? Well, wood chipping and brush clearing are cost prohibitive.
Right, very expensive.
Incredibly expensive, and they're actually a very damaging process to a lot of other. One of the reasons why the state in a park doesn't want people that live near the edge of the park to go ahead and do their own clearing is because they don't really know what they're doing.
They might clear the good plants as well as the bad ones.
And the people that would be contacted with the state might not know either. I assume that they would be under the eye of a biologist. All these things cost a ton of money. Fire is probably the easiest and cheapest thing to do. Unless, of course, it gets out of control.
Is the problem when you have an indiscriminate burn where it's burning not just, say, some grasses around the periphery or something like that, but when you're starting to burn perhaps mature trees or saplings or native plants that actually are fairly fire resistant?
Yes, and one of the things that has changed about the ecology, too, since the white man has basically moved into the American Southwest, the whole Cuyamaca area was once designated as a national forest. These were places that were they imagined they would be using for lumber. You know?
Really?
So the idea is to always keep fires from happening in order to conserve your resources. The things that the Indians would do is they would burn it on a regular basis based on their intimate knowledge of it and reduce the number of trees. So if you look at photographs in the 1800s of different national parks in the Southwest, they're much, much, much more sparse than they are today.
Interesting.
A lot less ponderosa pine, a lot less other kinds of pines.
Interesting.
So we've kind of painted ourselves into a corner. Now we have a natural high build of fuel. But at the same time, if you burn it out at the wrong time of year and you end up with weeds, you just have a tinderbox.
Yeah, it's worse.
Yeah.
The other thing I'd like to talk about is for homeowners or property owners out there who may want to reduce their risk of becoming victims of a wildfire and yet also want to have plants that are beautiful, perhaps plants that are drought resistant, and not have other problems like something that's poisonous to animals. What are some of the species of plants that you recommend people plant that are fire safe and without creating additional problems?
There's quite a lot, actually. If you live on the lower elevations, there are several great plants that you can plant on the periphery of your property. Mm-hmm. One is called Atroplex. The common name is saltbush. You can get that at several native plant nurseries around, and I recommend Recon.
Yeah, saltbush, I know you've said before, is something that's good for holding slopes also. If you have a steep slope, erosion problems.
Saltbush can hold slopes. The best part about saltbush is its fire resistance. It basically collects the salt in the soil and puts it in its leaves, and it's very, very difficult to burn. I mean, if you could sit there with a match all day and night, it won't light on fire. One of the ones that I think near the coast that's a terrific plant is called lemonade berry. It's easy to grow. Any homeowner can grow it.
Can you grow it in the inland areas too?
Absolutely. But there's a Russovada. It's called sugar bush. It's very closely related to lemonade berry. It tends to grow at 1,000 feet elevation and higher, and that's probably what the species that you would choose. Lemonade berry is very frost sensitive. So sugarbush and lemonade berry, the great thing about them, a lot of people, what they don't like about a lot of native plants is that they go dormant in the summertime. Neither of these plants go dormant. They have beautiful flowers, and they have the lemonade berry, for example, has a fun little fruit that you can either suck on or put in a glass of water and taste just like lemonade.
Oh, interesting. So that's where it got the name.
Yeah. Both of these plants are in the cashew family, which is also the poison oak. And poison ivy are also in the cashew family, so that gives you an idea of that.
So you don't want those.
Yeah, you don't want to eat the plant and, you know, things like that. But
it's not, you don't get a rash or anything from them, right?
No. There's one plant called Rus laurina. The names have been changed because botanists keep changing the name. Mm-hmm. But that's the one people know all the time. They know it as sumac.
Yeah.
That one.
That's poisonous.
It is. That is also a fire hazard. You don't want to plant that near your house.
Are there a couple of other plants that you especially like for a fire prevention standpoint?
Yeah, absolutely. The Baccharis's common name is broom. It's a evergreen plant. Mm-hmm. There's many, many species that grow in San Diego County, depending on where you live in the county. And some of them are actually endangered. So I encourage people to grow endangered plants.
What else?
I would recommend for people, as opposed to a fire barrier, a lot of our local plants, everybody is a fan of the ceanothus. Its common name is mountain lilac. We have many species of ceanothus.
Beautiful lavender blooms in the springtime on those.
Gorgeous. It's a gorgeous plant. It's an evergreen plant. It's very easy to grow if you don't overwater it. Mm-hmm. I recommend for people to grow mature plants and keep the underbrush down. Weed control is key, and it's pretty easy. You're not going to, if you plant up with mature native plants, you won't have any problem. You're not going to do much damage killing everything that's under them.
Can you get more information about these plants and others at the California Native Plant Society website?
You can. I think for homeowners, I think one of the best websites around is called Las Palitas. It's a nursery that they have a branch in Escondido and the main branch in San Luis Obispo. Mm-hmm. They have one of the most complete and interesting guide online, and they do sell plants too.
Oh, very good. Certainly the Water Conservation Garden out at Cuyamaca College has a lot of information and plants there that are native?
They do. My big obsession is bringing the things that are local and from your local environment. They grow better, and people get bitten by the bug. Once they start getting into it, I'm working now with the Mount Helix Park Association and restoring the park up there.
Very nice.
And we're going to be using the material there in the park and in the local environment. And these things are guaranteed to live, and we have a lot of beautiful things. And once people get into looking at them, they start to see things differently. They start to see what's a weed and what's not a weed, and they begin to realize how beautiful the Mediterranean environment that we have is, and they start to plant them in their yards.
Well, wonderful. If people want to get more information or get involved with the California Native Plant Society, Ed, where can they get more information?
On the website. They can go to the website and join.
So you can Google California Native Plant Society and get the website. It's right here in San Diego.
Right. And they have meetings in the park. They can be informative. You can find a lot of people to give you information, things like that. Mm-hmm. And they have a newsletter, which is always important.
Do they have outings where you can go out and look at some of these plants and things?
They do. I tend to go on my own mostly, and I'd be happy to organize hikes for people.
Mm-hmm. What is your email?
epifardini@gmail.com. The most amazing thing about San Diego County is we have so many microclimates, and we have over 2,600 native species of plants, and many of them exist nowhere else on Earth outside of San Diego County.
Very good. And Ed, I'm going to ask, if people want to get in touch with you directly, can you spell out your email address, please?
Yes, epifardini@gmail.com. That's E, P as in Peter, I, F as in Frank, A-R-D-I-N-I, cannabisinfo@gmail.com. If you have questions about plants, identification and things like that, you can email me a picture and I'll send you back what they are. And if you have concerns about what's a weed, what's not a weed, I can let you know and what you should plant and around your house.
Well, very good. I want to thank you very much, Ed, for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
Okay, thank you very much.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Crime Beat report. A gruesome discovery was made early Sunday morning in Alpine. An employee with the Sweetwater Authority found a burning body lying in a dirt road off the Sequan Truck Trail. The body, which has not been identified, was still smoldering, said Lieutenant Glenn Gianantonio with the Sheriff's Homicide Unit. The Sheriff's Homicide, Bomb Arson, and Crime Units are investigating this horrific discovery. If you have any information about what may have happened, investigators ask that you please call 858-974-2321. You can also call Crime Stoppers at 888-580-8477.
This is Leon Thompson with the Health Report. A case of tuberculosis has been reported at Helix Charter High School in La Mesa. Students and staff may have been exposed, according to County Health and Human Services Agency. HHSA is working closely with the school to notify anyone who was potentially exposed. The period of possible exposure was from September 8, 2013 through February 24, 2014. Free testing for students who were potentially exposed took place on March 6th and 7th at the school. Many hours of close indoor contact with an infected individual is usually needed to spread TB to others, and most people who are exposed do not develop TB, said Dr. Eric McDonald, County Deputy Public Health Officer. TB is easiest to treat and cure with medications when identified early, which is why it's important to identify those who have been exposed, he added. Symptoms of active TB include persistent cough, fever, night sweats, and unexplained weight loss. Countywide, there have been 14 cases of TB reported so far in 2014. There were 206 TB cases in 2013 and 234 reported in 2012. For more information about the potential exposure, call the County of San Diego TB program at 619-692-8621.
They are the first line of public safety. They answer calls from people during the worst moments of their lives. They give up family time, weekends and holidays, work graveyard shifts, and make critical decisions in life and death situations. When a call for help is made, the voice on the other end is a sheriff's dispatcher. Now the Sheriff's 911 Communications Center is looking for emergency services dispatchers and radio trainees. Recruitment for these positions will remain open until Friday, March 14th. All applicants will be required to undergo a comprehensive background check. After March 14th, these positions will open again for applications every first and second week of each month. The San Diego Sheriff's 911 Communications Center is staffed 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Emergency services dispatchers process over 1,600 calls for law enforcement services each day, and about a third of those are 911 calls. The state's recommended average answering time for 911 calls is 10 seconds. San Diego Sheriff's dispatchers' annual average answering time on 911 calls was 5 seconds. For more information on becoming an emergency service dispatcher or radio trainee, contact the county's job hotline at 858-505-6576. This has been a public service announcement for the San Diego Sheriff's Department.
District Court Judge Janice San Martino heard testimony from legal representatives for both sides in a lawsuit brought by the Protect Our Communities Foundation against the Bureau of Land Management, or the BLM, over approvals for the controversial Tule Wind Project planned in Boulevard's McCain Valley Recreation and Conservation Area in East County. The Protect Our Communities attorney, Stephen Volker, was surprised by the judge's announcement that she had a tentative ruling in hand. The judge read that ruling and allowed a 15-minute break for attorneys to prepare a response. Each side was then given a half hour to argue their points and 1 minute for rebuttal. No copies of the tentative ruling were distributed at the hearing, and none are currently available. Judge San Martino discussed the court's findings, which aligned with the Bureau of Land Management's approvals. But because of the restrictions imposed by the judge, the plaintiffs claimed that they were not able to make an adequate presentation of most of their concerns, including the adverse impact on human health, increased bird mortality, and noise to nearby residents. The plaintiffs appealed to the court to consider the lack of accounting for alternative energy projects that would be more cost-effective, reliable, and provide for lower greenhouse gas emissions, such as passive solar plants and rooftop solar. And finally, although East County Magazine has reported the concerns of residents about fire hazards, that issue was not discussed at the March 4th hearing. The hearing was to hear oral arguments for and against the initial court findings. A final decision by Judge San Martino will be made after careful analysis, hopefully within the next few days. The Protect Our Community's lead attorney, Steve Volker, spoke of the impact of infrasound very low frequency and often below hearing range. It has been cited for causing anxiety, uneasiness, nervousness, headaches, night terrors, sleep problems, ringing in the ear, memory problems, and feelings of pressure on the chest. Complaints similar to those that have been made by residents living around the Kumeyaay Wind and the Ocotillo Wind turbines. According to an MIT study, the rapid spinning of wind turbine blades can produce sound and vibration as well as disrupting an air pressure that lead to infrasound problems. It is thought to be a cause of bats dying near wind turbines. The attorneys representing the Bureau of Land Management refuted the plaintiff's complaints, saying that the environmental impact studies did adequately address each issue. The Thule project will provide 186 megawatts of clean, renewable energy and provide a number of jobs, said the Bureau of Land Management attorney. They also argued against the negative impact of infrasound on humans, saying, scientific studies indicate that only audible noise impacts humans. There is no evidence in the literature of any health effects from infrasound noise. One plea from the attorneys representing the POC was the lack of discussion of distributed energy. For example, any discussion of better alternatives that would be more cost-effective and better for the environment. The environmental impact report completely swept aside any talk of alternative distributed energy projects such as rooftop solar, said attorney Steve Volker. There was disagreement about the effect the project would have on migratory birds, specifically the golden eagle. Attorney Volker indicated that in the environmental impact study, estimates that up to 37 raptors per year might be killed. Yet the opposing attorney, Mr. Martin, for the BLM, stated it is unlikely that any eagles would be taken. The project's environmental impact report relied on studies conducted by now discredited raptor expert David Bittner, who was convicted in federal court on various raptor-related violations, including illegally taking a golden eagle and refusing to turn over tracking data on eagles in the U.S. to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service after taking money from energy companies, as East County Magazine previously reported. Donna Tisdale, Secretary of Protect Our Communities, expressed her frustration. We are so incredibly frustrated that the court system continues to condone and allow the Bureau of Land Management and the Bureau of Indian Affairs and others to willfully ignore all the harm that these massive wind turbine projects inflict on impacted residents, wildlife, recreation, conservation areas, and more, she said.
This is a public service announcement from East County Magazine. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts provide important information about much more than wildfires. In these winter months, you can receive free alerts via email or Twitter on your mobile phone
about emergencies such as flash floods, road closures, heavy snow, and other severe weather alerts, as well as wildfires, traffic reports, and more. You can sign up for this free public service at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Indians.
The income tax filing deadline is now less than 2 months away, but it can be less taxing for those 60 and older. AARP's tax aid program helps middle and lower income older Californians prepare basic federal and state income tax returns for free. Sheree Gillens with AARP California says they have 3,000 volunteer tax preparers ready to help at hundreds of sites across California.
They're there to walk the taxpayer through the various questions that they have and to, you know, get some money back into their hands.
The program was started in 1968. Gillen says last year they helped Californians secure $92 million in income tax refunds. While the program is catered to those 60 and older, it's open to everyone, and AARP membership is not required.
They're trained on the type of tax questions that come from AARP members and retirees. Sometimes there's new provisions and forms that are relevant to them, or sometimes there's a spouse who doesn't know how to proceed because, you know, their spouse is gone.
Gillen says walk-ins are welcome, but appointments are encouraged.
They can go to aarp.org/findtaxhelp, or they can call 888-227-7669. Either of those places will help you locate a site in your community. There's over 465 sites in California alone.
It's important to bring all of your tax documents, including last year's tax returns, Social Security cards, or other official documentation for yourself and your dependents. For Public News Service, I'm Lori Abbott.
This is Ed Barreno with a sports report. A San Diego State University staff member who lost a leg in Afghanistan has been honored by the San Diego Hall of Champions. Eric McElvaney was named Challenged Athlete of the Year at the Salute to the Champions Awards ceremony after accomplishments that would be daunting for many able-bodied athletes. A former Marine captain who was stationed at Camp Pendleton, he volunteered for a tour of duty in Afghanistan in 2011, where he was wounded by an improvised explosive device. His leg had to be amputated below the knee. But it hasn't slowed him down. I set a goal that when the other three members of my unit returned in mid-April, I'd be there to greet them, standing, vowed McElvaney, who did just that. Just 8 months after losing his leg, he competed in his first spring triathlon. 2 months later, he ran his first marathon. He went on to compete in the grueling Ironman triathlon in Hawaii last summer, which includes a 2.5-mile swim, a 112-mile bike race, and a 26-mile marathon. Even for the fittest competitors, it's one of the most challenging events of its kind. McElvaney finished in 11 hours and 50 minutes. Nowadays, he enjoys mentoring veterans. After transitioning from battlefield to civilian life at SDSU, McElvaney is assistant director of the Troops to Engineers program. With their military backgrounds, many of these students are finding careers in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. It's something bigger than me, says McElvaney, who knows firsthand the importance of help and support. In accepting his award, he praised the Challenge Athletes Foundation and the San Diego community for assisting him in attaining his dreams. While he has been focused on his training and his goals, he said the award came as a surprise. To have the community recognize those accomplishments was a really cool experience, he concluded.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.